From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Well, President Obama has apparently fired back at those who circulated the so-called dissent memo regarding Syria. In yesterday's press briefing at the White House, Josh Earnest was asked about the so-called dissent letter, and this is what he said in response.
The president approves of this well-established process at the State Department. There should be an opportunity for people who do have a dissent to register to do so, and that's a healthy part of the process. And look, the president has long acknowledged how difficult the situation in Syria is, and so the president would certainly welcome new ideas that are put forward for confronting it. But I do want to go back to one element of your question, which is, and this is sort of the way that it's the way that this is often considered, is that somehow the use of the United States military could be used to enhance the leverage of the United States. I'm not really sure what that means. I think what it means is that we should direct the force of the United States military against the Assad regime. And I think there are a lot of questions that are raised about that. First of all, how do you do that without harming innocent civilians? Second of all, I'm not sure exactly what legal authority the president would rely on to do something like that. And three, it seems like a slippery slope. Does that just mean that there's one round of missile strikes and then we spend a month trying to negotiate again, and then if nothing happens, do we launch more missile strikes, or then do we have to steadily ramp up the military engagement? And at what point does that stop? It's hard to imagine where that stops, that somehow stops short of a war against a sovereign nation that is being backed by Russia and Iran in a way that it's unclear to me how exactly that is going to apply additional pressure against ISIL, which is the extremist organization that we obviously are quite concerned about.
Both the overt acknowledgement of Syria's sovereignty and the dangers of entangling with Russia and Iran in Syria were first from the White House. The presidential spokesperson's words seemed at odds with words that came from Defense Secretary Ashton Carter only a day before.
In this new era, we face no fewer than five immediate, evolving challenges. First, countering the prospect of Russian aggression and coercion, especially in Europe. Second, managing historic change in the vital Asia-Pacific region, where China is rising, which is fine, but behaving aggressively, which is not. Strengthening our deterrent and defense forces in the face of North Korea's nuclear and missile provocations and threats to our allies. Checking Iranian aggression and malign influence in the Gulf. And we must and we are combating terrorism, including accelerating the defeat of ISIL. Last week's tragic shooting in Orlando underscores the urgency of that last one. It reminds us that ISIL not only tyrannizes the population where it arose in Syria and Iraq, but it also wants to spread its evil ideology and to plot or inspire attacks on Americans, including here at home. And Orlando further steels our resolve to carry out all the aspects of our coalition military campaign plan. First, destroying ISIL's parent tumor in Iraq and Syria, which is necessary, not sufficient, because second, we need to combat ISIL's metastases worldwide, wherever it appears, and third, help protect the homeland and our people. Now, we don't have the luxury of choosing among these five different challenges. We must and will address them all across the spectrum of conflict.
After Carter made his remarks, late Wednesday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin said this.
What more lessons are necessary today to cast away old ideological disagreements and geopolitical games and to unite in the fight against international terrorism? Russia is open for discussion on this most important question and has repeatedly expressed its readiness for dialogue. However, we now again as it was in the Second World War, don't see positive reactions. On the contrary, NATO is strengthening its rhetoric and its aggressive actions close to our borders. In this environment, we must pay special attention to strengthening our country's defense capabilities.
The vote counting is still going on in California, with more than 680,000 ballots not yet tallied, including 474,000 ballots from independent voters whom polls showed heavily favored Democratic hopeful Bernie Sanders. As we've previously reported, early returns heavily favored former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, apparently taken from districts where she was running the strongest, which resulted in media coverage that indicated the former Secretary of State had won big. Shortly after polls closed on primary day, Clinton was ahead 60.4% to Sanders' 38.5%, a 21.6% lead. The two were evenly split in later returns overnight, which cut Clinton's overall lead to about 12.5% at 58.8%. The ballots have been counted continuously since 2.5 million unopened ballots were reported by the California Secretary of State a few days after Clinton had been declared the winner. As of the opening of business this past Monday, California's Board of Elections still had more than 1.2 million uncounted ballots, while Clinton's lead had been cut to about 460,000 votes. As of Thursday morning, Sanders has closed the lead to about 9% at about 54% to 45%, or about 440,000 out of about 2.9 million votes, with a total of 680,000 ballots remaining unopened. In her weekly Freedom Rider column at blackagendareport.com, columnist Margaret Kimberly writes about the relationship between the Orlando massacre and U.S. foreign policy. She writes, "The terms lone wolf and self-radicalization make no sense when the FBI won't leave Muslim Americans alone, but instead lures them into terror plots, and the U.S. provides arms, money, and protection for jihadist terror overseas." We spoke with Margaret Kimberly via Skype Thursday. Margaret, welcome back. A pleasure.
Thank you, Don.
This week's column is an interesting one, taking a look at the internal and external policies of violence and practice of violence in the United States, tying together Orlando and foreign policy adventures of the U.S. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, when the news first broke about the killing of 49 people at a gay nightclub in Orlando, at first it seemed to be an ordinary, dare I say, ordinary mass shooting that seemed to crop up a couple of times a year in this country, and then it turned out the shooter had apparently claimed an allegiance to ISIS. It turned out he was a Muslim. He was born in the U.S. His parents were from Afghanistan. And so the story, you know, and whenever these things happen, there's so much press, and it's difficult to decipher what is or isn't true, and it's just an overabundance of mostly useless information. But little by little, we learned that at first it seemed like perhaps this was a gay hate crime, and there is some evidence that he was a closeted gay man. The FBI released some portions of the 911 calls while he was in the nightclub. He made several 911 calls, and while they did redact some of it, they said they didn't want to help promote ISIS. He made references to the United States not intervening in the Middle East, stopping bombing in Iraq and Syria, and apparently said something about ISIS. So there's a lot going on with this guy. He has a history of apparent mental illness going back to his youth, many, many violent threats against other people. He lost jobs over it. He was investigated by the FBI on at least two occasions, and after one of those occasions, he threatened a coworker by claiming to know Al-Qaeda operatives, and he said, "Al-Qaeda's going to get you," or something along those lines, and the FBI tried to turn him into an informant. So we have somebody with mental health issues, and I think this is something that has to be talked about. While there are people who need mental health care, I think many of them have been and will continue to be still inspired by political grievances.
Yeah, which almost everyone in the country has, with the exception of a very small class.
Yes, exactly. And so we can't just dismiss and say, well, he's a crazy guy. Well, you know, crazy people act out, too, and they'll act out in the way that an unstable, disturbed person will act out. So, and a couple of days ago, a man came forward anonymously, not identifying himself by name, who said he had a sexual relationship with Omar Mateen, was his name, with Mateen. And so everyone seems to think, well, that settles it. It was all about him being a closeted gay man, and he was, you know, allegedly had a partner who told him he was HIV positive, and he threatened to get back at him. And
let me ask you a question about something too, because this is something that gets overlooked a lot. I mean, you mentioned, and you know, you have front and center the fact that, you know, he's a Muslim living in the United States whose parents basically fled Afghanistan, forgetting his father's role in all of that. Dr. Joy DeGruy talks about the trauma that slavery inflicted on people that is still manifest today. What kind of impacts do you think these wars that we've been conducting in all of these countries have on people that make their way to apparently a safe environment, you know, but isn't really because of how they got there?
Well, you know, let's not forget, had the United States not intervened in Afghanistan, if the government, despite the fact that we were told that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, the government there, a left-wing government, invited the Soviets in to assist them.
All right, to defend them against the people that had been stirred up and armed by the CIA.
By the CIA and the Saudis. And the United States, nobody wants to talk about it now, at the time, were allies of the Taliban, were allies of Osama bin Laden. So it was all of this conflict instigated by the U.S., which drove people like the Mateen family to this country. And, of course, you have that trauma, and there's also an element of, you know, exiles, be they from Afghanistan or Cuba or any number of places in the world, who are supported by the U.S., who are elevated and told that their cause is just. They never lose that feeling of being exceptional in some way. And, of course, they pass that on to their children. And the father apparently had his own issues, very serious issues.
Sure.
He claimed to be the president in exile of Afghanistan. He had his own, video program. He claimed to be the president of Afghanistan. So he had some problems of his own.
Yeah.
So he's raised in this household of delusions of grandeur. And the father had become quite prosperous. I'm sure he's one of these people who was set up here, had various business enterprises. So we have someone who has connections to the U.S. government, who's living here in grievance, who's told, you know, we're going to help you, I don't know, perhaps go back to your country. Who knows what sorts of things the father thought. And then we have this son who is not given the care he obviously needed. So he, you know, his first wife had to leave him. She was a victim of domestic violence. He threatened people many times. So it's this weird nexus of personal issues, but which are, in this case, we have a family that wouldn't even be in the country absent the United States involvement in their homeland.
That's right.
And now he is, as most Muslims are in the world, angry about the U.S. Intervening in that part of the world. So at various times he claimed allegiance to Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and ISIS, being a not very stable person. But apparently it was ISIS that he focused on at the end when he, on the occasion when he killed these people. But I also think we can't overlook the fact the FBI tried to turn him into an informant.
Yeah, that's
talk about that. And that's something that has been glossed over when he used the name of Al-Qaeda to issue a threat to another individual. The FBI tried to turn him, and we're told that he did not bite, as it is how it's described. Yeah. So we have a man who's a troubled person, but who was still inspired, and he won't be the last troubled person who will be inspired by anger at the United States for foreign policy. So we can't just wash our hands with he was closeted, he was crazy. Crazy people still focus on something. And the United States has done enough wrong in the world for people to focus on that and to carry out acts of violence because of it.
Yeah. Over the weekend, I saw CNN was interviewing a guy in Georgia who was a gun advocate. Even this guy, who was clearly very, you know, he was a right-wing white guy in his 40s or so.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that he had front and center was the lack of available mental health care. He said in the county he was in, I forgot what county he was in Georgia, he said, you know, there's maybe 12,000 people that are in severe need of mental health care, and there are 12 beds.
Yes. Well, that's something going on all over the country. I have a relative who works at a state psychiatric facility here in New York City, who tells me about the constant reduction in the number of beds. New York City obviously would do better than Georgia, but the effort is not to. There are some states that don't have psychiatric hospitals at all. So we have people not being treated or not being treated sufficiently who can also get access to guns. It's a recipe for disaster. I'm actually surprised when you think about it that there aren't more mass killings in this country, given the opportunity that people have with the ease of acquiring firearms and the number of people who are untreated. So, yes, we can look forward to, sadly, more incidents of this type happening.
And the piles of grievances, too.
Yes, absolutely. And who doesn't? I guess that's the thing. It's, you know, what keeps... fortunately, most people from going over that line, but it's just dumb luck that we don't have more people who are angry. I was thinking about a man in New York City last year who shot and killed two policemen. He was angry about police brutality.
Right.
And he came all the way from another state. He came from, I believe, from Baltimore and shot two cops sitting in a patrol car. And he was another person. He had a history of mental illness, but he was also angry about, quite legitimately angry about police brutality. And he took two lives. So this is something that we're going to have to face up to in this country. But, you know, we live in a country where austerity is the rule, even in supposedly liberal states like New York. So there's less and less access to care for people who... are in need of it. So there are going to be more Omar Mateens. While his circumstances may have been very particular, I think we have to know that America's actions around the world and the involvements we've had, which have disrupted people's lives, will come to a head with tragedies like this.
You know, it was 53 years ago or something that Malcolm X, when JFK was assassinated, made the famous comment about chickens coming home to roost. And when he actually had an opportunity to articulate what he meant, he was talking about U.S. foreign policy with the violence that it brings all over the world. And the same condition prevails now, perhaps it's much greater in terms of its breadth and depth. What's it going to take?
I think it's worth pointing out that JFK had other people assassinated. As soon as he came to office, the CIA gave a green light for the Belgians to kill Patrice Lumumba.
Right.
He had a hand in assassinating or giving permission for the assassination of Vietnamese President Diem.
Right.
So yes, chickens definitely come home to roost in this country that's rooted in violence, that exists because of violence and conquest, and that exists with many, many outbreaks of violence against indigenous people, and mostly against the original indigenous population and the black population. When this story first broke, the media was saying it was the worst mass killing in U.S. history. Well, that's not true. It was the worst mass killing carried out by an individual with a gun. But there have been many mass killings. If you talk about Wounded Knee and the Tulsa, I don't know why it's called a riot. It was a massacre. Colfax, Louisiana, Sand Creek in Colorado. It could go on and on and on. So this is something, you know, they try, and it's a dodge to say it in modern history or whatever, but those massacres need to be mentioned. They were all the results of white supremacy, and they should be remembered that way. And many people said it's like a competition, and no, it's not. It's just history. It's just fact. And if we're going to talk about things, we should at least go through the motions of being accurate, I think.
You know, looking at Trump yesterday says, on the one hand, they're carving out space for the political campaign for the gun issue to be, you know, dividing line between Clinton and Trump. That Clinton is in favor of reasonable gun control and that Trump is a gun nut, whatever. And I'm wondering, though, and, you know, at the same speech that he was giving yesterday, he talked about Clinton having blood on her hands because of, and he detailed the destruction of Iraq and of Libya. I'm wondering how the American public looks at those things in totality. On the one hand, you have this action at the House of Representatives yesterday, the grandstanding over, you know, gun control legislation that probably won't control guns. And in the context, by the way, of, you know, Paris, guns are illegal and people manage to have assault rifles somehow. I don't know how that works. But also, you know, U.S. foreign policy being the most bloodthirsty actor on the stage. And those guns are all made here, both the guns that are used here and used abroad.
Yes, they are. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know where to begin, but the sit-down protest that the Democrats had in Congress yesterday was just ridiculous. They want to use, they're trying to pass a bill that would prevent people who are on the no-fly lists or other security watch lists from legally acquiring guns. Well, those lists are highly problematic. There's several things wrong with that. Right. The no-fly list, for example, no one knows how you get on the no-fly list. No one knows how to get off the no-fly list.
Due process.
There are toddlers on the no-fly list. There are kids 2 and 3 years old. Their parents get to the airport and find out they're on the no-fly list. So the idea of using the no-fly list and then invoking the name of King, I mean, I don't know where to begin with this.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that whole stunt was, you know, ended up being a campaign commercial for Jill Stein, as far as I'm concerned. It was so ridiculous. But yeah, that's where we are now with debate over handguns, where it is, people, NRA types have a point that people have always been able to get guns illegally. I do think we need to find a way to restrict, I don't know how you do it, with millions of guns around the country. And most of us are endangered by criminal activity and not by people who go to an NRA convention.
Right.
So it's very, very difficult in a country with this history and the lack of political will to do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, the country was actually taken at gunpoint.
Yes, it was. I mean, exists quite literally because of violence. We had this country was founded by a settler population, and they very nearly exterminated the original population, and in many cases, exterminated them to get their land, to create a plantation economy, so enslaved millions of other people. So that's a legacy I don't know how to get rid of, absent a revolution and a true commitment. to talk about what that means.
What do you think are the chances of actually outlawing the manufacture of weapons, like of guns, basically, and outlawing their import?
Well, I don't know how you would do that. It would be, there would have to be a mass demand for that to happen, but lest we forget, there are millions of people in this country who are opposed to any restrictions on guns, on manufacture, on sale, on distribution, on purchase. So the NRA, whatever else we can say about it, is a grassroots organization. Their politics aren't mine, but there are millions of people who would be opposed to that. So I don't see it as having a chance. The gun manufacturing lobby is very like any other industry that makes a lot of money. They're very politically active. So I don't see how that would happen at this time.
And I'm wondering maybe if some kind of action at the United Nations to outlaw guns, weapons, all of that stuff would play out at the Security Council.
Yes, I can't see America would veto that, first of all. So I think our country would be the obstructionist if, and I don't believe the United States is bound by UN resolutions domestically. I'm not sure if that could work.
No. Finally, the piece draws the connection between violence at home and violence abroad. And as we mentioned earlier, I mean, this has been on the agenda. You know, people have been pointing this out forever. I just pulled Malcolm X out of my head from 53 mm-hmm. years ago. The peace movement doesn't really seem to make that connection. Those, you know, the people at the organizers do and folks that lecture on it do. But when you see the demands that are raised in the public sphere generally, they don't make that connection very effectively. How could you drive that point home?
Well, it's all wrapped up in Americans' image of themselves and their country. Even people who claim to be on the liberal side, when you scratch the surface, you find out most of them are not opposed to violent interventions in the world. They just care if it's carried out by somebody they like or not. So the peace movement was, unfortunately, mostly made up of people who were anti-Republican. They weren't really pro-peace or anti-U.S. interventions. They were quite happy to back interventions once there was a Democrat in office and somebody they liked. And they can make arguments. They'll, you know, claim it's for humanitarian reasons, and the next thing you know, the United States has destroyed Libya and is trying to destroy Syria. And there's still a very small cohort of people who oppose these actions. And it's generally couched in terms of how much money we spend, or look at Libya, it's a mess, but very few people are willing to talk about the fact that America just does not have the right, should not have the right, to make these decisions for people all over the world. So the peace movement has to really find its identity. And those of us who are truly against U.S. interventions need to find a way to improve our message and our coalitions so that we change the conversation from whether this or that intervention had a quote-unquote good outcome to the fact that the United States has no business intervening at all.
Margaret Kimberly, this week's column, Freedom Rider, Orlando, and U.S. Foreign Policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Margaret Kimberly does have a weekly column at blackagendareport.com entitled Freedom Rider. We've been discussing this week's edition of that column. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.